And he always does.
Always. They never change that up, play with it, trick you.
Right.
No. And nor does he ever seem to get used to it. Every time it's like, what happened? Like the same thing that happened to you. Episode one.
Yes, he keeps falling for it. At some point, you'd be like, wait a second. This is the part where I wake up and it's in my bed.
All right.
Okay.
Dude, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Did I just watch... with this series, Archive 81, did I just watch your life story as an editor?
that's the life of cutting actors' reels. Yeah, that's what it was like when I was doing that.
Probably specifically mine.
It's pretty accurate. It is kind of what it feels like to be editing a project. Yeah.
I figured, like, you know, feel like you're going into different dimensions, time, space, 1920s flashbacks.
All bets are off. Yeah.
Mold hallucinations. You just don't know where you are.
Strange animal friends. Yeah.
And what I really thought of was, like, how many times have actors handed you pieces of tape like this poor protagonist had to fix? And you basically have to take a Q-tip and some rubbing alcohol and fix the VHS copy of the commercial they did in 1977.
Yeah. Scrape off the debris and the mold and the, yeah. And find a codec that works. It was a very accurate depiction.
Okay, well, that's been a review of Archive 81.
So you know my pain. I'm so delighted. It's such a lonely existence, the fact that you even understand it.
Yeah, no, I just pictured you like halfway through an actor's reel and just like walking into a different dimension and going like, hello, after a disembodied spirit.
That's very accurate. Very, very accurate. That's actually a really good take on this show, you know, on Archive 81. I mean, it really is kind of maybe the better way to look at it.
I wonder if it was an allegory for editing film.
You know, whoever edited it was having quite a time.
Because a lot of it, he's sitting in a room like editing and fixing.
Yeah,
we'll get there. I'm sorry, I didn't bury the lead. I'm a terrible host, as you know. By the time of the day I get to this show, I'm done thinking, which makes this very difficult, but
good for the audience though. They appreciate that.
You'll notice, welcome to Rated P for Paranormal. I'm Maddie Blake. That's Tony Arkin. Tony, you'll notice the audience can't see us, but we can see each other. And you'll notice I'm bathed in green light here at Maddie Road Studios because I have my now 17-year-old son gave me that LED lighting that all the kids are raging about in my studio. So I can change the color. And as we record this, it's St. Patrick's Day. So happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you too. I'm wearing all black today as is customary, I think. And I don't even think there's anything green in my office. That's terrible.
No, it's not. It's not your thing. Do you have any Irish in you at all?
I used to think so, but I believe that it's I do have Scottish in me and genes from the UK, but not from Ireland.
Would you like some?
Could you, do you have any that
That's
I
an
could
old joke?
Could I borrow some?
Do you have any Irish in you, honey? Would you like some?
It's yeah, exactly. I was taking the high road and pretending that I didn't understand.
You do that a lot. You pretend you don't hear me.
Yeah, it's a good thing older people can do that, and you can avoid controversy and embarrassing situations.
My wife's last 25 years on earth
dealing with you
pretending she didn't hear me.
Well, yeah. What was that?
We went out to dinner recently with a couple friend, and I particularly, for whatever reason, can crack this girl up. And I was just going to, I got her early in the dinner, and I just doubled down. I just kept making her laugh, and she was laughing harder and harder. And I was getting bluer and bluer and more ridiculous and preposterous, making her burst out in laughter. And then Colleen at one point just leans over to her and goes, "What are you doing? Stop. Don't encourage him." Not to me, to her. She got mad at her. Yeah. When you do that, he'll keep going. You understand? Every time you laugh, she's like, "I know, I can't help it." I was in heaven. I was literally in heaven.
Yeah, they know. They're paying attention. They know. They just don't say. Yeah, he's doing that again. Okay. Well, Sorry, I missed that.
Do we? So we're going to review Archive 81. If you're new to the show, we rate and review paranormal film and television.
Could you say that with a little bit more enthusiasm? Just at the beginning of this?
We just mentioned that you've edited my acting reel. You know I'm not that good of an actor.
Okay. Sorry.
We're going to review Archive 81, an American supernatural sci-fi mystery horror streaming television series based on a podcast, which you're not going to believe this, Tony. I actually went and listened to the pilot of the podcast of which this show is based.
Did you? I should have done that. That was stupid of me.
No, you shouldn't have.
Oh, okay.
I didn't get very far in the pilot.
Oh, dear. Okay. So, in other words, we have a shot maybe at getting a show then that we could maybe do it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, for the first time, I'm in the right place at the right time.
We have no shot. This was a scripted podcast, a dramatic podcast.
Okay.
And so...
Like a radio show. Like
an old-timey radio show, yeah. which, by the way, I'm a podcast fanatic. I listen to mostly podcasts throughout my day on all kinds of various subjects that I'm passionate about. But I've never tried the scripted podcast thing ever once. I'm totally into that genre. I could see myself loving one. I didn't particularly love this one. I think we're not reviewing a podcast here, but the I was really having trouble with the voiceover acting in it. So I bailed early, but I'm open to that genre. I think it'd be real cool. Have you listened to a scripted podcast series ever?
On occasion. I'm kind of like you. I've dipped in and out to see what was going on, and I've heard stuff I liked and stuff I didn't. I mean, it's been a mixed bag. I've also been listening to podcasts really since they started. I've been kind of into them. Just how many different things you can follow and learn about has been fantastic. I've done more than I've heard, actually. I used to do radio theater with the Maury Sendak had a theater company in New York, and they did some radio shows, and I was part of that. It's a really fun medium to do. I think it's very, very hard to do it well for the audience. I do love it when it's done well.
Yeah, I could really see that. I'm going to ask you for some recommendations off the air because I do. That's something I think I would enjoy. I would imagine based on what I heard, you would need to really have talented voice actors doing it, like yourself and people like that to, you know, make it.
Yeah, I mean, it's performance, it's acting, it is. So it's like you need good actors. It's like you're going to get. You get what you pay for. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Podcasts are free most of the time, so whatever.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's, you know, sometimes you get like dinner theater in Oswego, New York, and sometimes you get like a cool off-Broadway show vibe.
And sometimes both have their merit.
Yeah. Sometimes Oswego's theater is just swinging. So.
Well, I'm reminiscing about St. Patrick's Day gone by, and some wild ones in my past, of course, but I think one of the best days of my life was on St. Patrick's Day 2005, because that's the day we brought home my son Max, who turned 17 on the 15th. He was due on St. Patrick's Day, born on the 15th, came a couple of days early, but we brought him home on St. Patrick's Day, the day
amazing
he was due.
Oh, and, wow.
You know, I just blinked and he turned 17. So I'm you know, it's just crazy. I don't know what my point was, but I've been thinking about that.
Outside of that lovely, cherished story about your family, what's the really, really cool St. Patrick's Day, though? The other one that you don't, you might not want to tell on air. You can cut this part out.
There's so many. There was a place called Patty Burke's I used to go to. It's in downtown Boston, right across the way from the old Boston Garden. And my best friend and roommate of the time, one of my best friends who I lived with in Boston, had a connection to Patty Burke's. Patty Burke's was a Flatiron, you know, that building, the Flatiron, that
oh sure, yeah,
Flatiron building that's triangle shaped. So picture that, but mini. It was a triple decker in a triangle shape right on the corner of the street. And it was 100% everyone that worked there was off the boat from Ireland, had a thick brogue. That place, people started lining up at 9 a.m. They opened the doors, I believe, at 10 a.m. And it was just jammed all day, all night on St. Patrick's Day in Boston. And I had days there St. Patrick's Day, about a 4-year run where I
redacted content. Redacted content.
He's like, no, they're from Ireland.
But they casting some spells over you. That's for sure.
Redacted content.
I had a great one actually, because I got to see Shane McGowan play at the Bowery Ballroom with the Popes, which is an offshoot of the Pogues on St. Patty's Day night.
Dude, so and you are Irish. You became.
They bled me in. They bled me into the thing, and I'm now officially a member. Because I knew a guy who ran it, you know, or not ran it, but who was a guitar tech and helped run the band a little bit on the road. And he said, my dear friend, Brucey said it was
Bruce. I met Brucey.
You met Brucey, yeah.
Austin, yeah.
Brucey is he's a professional, and yep. He said this was a rough tour.
Oh,
this is a rough one.
I can imagine.
But backstage, hanging out in the green room with Spider and the gang.
My God.
Oh Lord, that was incredible.
My God, that's a life experience. By the by, in this show, Archive 81, there's at least one or two I can think of. There's palm slicing. People slice, and I want to do this as a top three, not tonight because we already have a top three picked, which we'll get to, but I want to do a top three hand slicing moments in film history, because it's such a cliche that people like do a pact or it's either a cultish procedure ritual, or it's like a pact between soldiers and they cut their hand, they go like that, and I'm like, people do this very easily. If I sliced my own hand on purpose with a knife, I'd be bedridden for a week.
Yeah, but they also really go for it too. It's like, can't you just like do a little nick on your thumb and like just wouldn't that be okay? It's got to be this incredible gash in your hand.
They slice right across. You're yeah. right.
You wouldn't be able to work your hand at all. It would like right? you'd have to go to surgery.
And they barely wince. Like,
yeah, hey.
I've cut myself. I don't just slap hands. No. I don't high five someone and mix our blood. I've never done that. I
cut myself shaving, and I'm like, you know, first of all, it's not very healthy probably to be mingling your open cut wounds with somebody else's. Doesn't sound.
I'm not sure what the CDC says about that, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, exactly. There's going to be, but there will be a commercial break about it tonight for sure at some point.
By the way, we just wrote a scene for Pound Ridge. You have the drum, blood oath, right? It's time for a blood oath. And then we just like barely prick our fingers and just touch our pinkies with little dots of blood. And then like, and then 5 minutes of the scene is us bandaging it.
Iodine. Like, yeah.
With the dramatic music, the military music.
And it's like, you know, riffing on the great scene where, like, you know, here we go again. Stallone comes into the conversation and I'm doing it, but like sewing up his arm, you know, first time we ever saw that in a movie, which became in every movie, we're like, you got to sew your own flesh up. Yeah. And we treat it the same way, except it's literally just like a Flintstone Band-Aid.
Yeah, we're doing that. Well, let's then get to, one piece of business. We got a great message. Speaking of top three, it just reminded me. I didn't prepare. Forgive me for all of you who have left messages and emails. I didn't compile them for tonight. I was reminded of this message by a regular listener, Matt C., a great guy. He's a passionate listener, and I appreciate it. Tony appreciates it. But he tried to leave us a voicemail, and forgive me if the Anchor voicemail system was down. I don't know if it was him or on that end. But if you'd like to leave us a message, you just go to anchor.fm/ratedparanormal, click on leave message, and you can actually leave us a voice message. It's awesome technology. It was down, or he couldn't do it. So he messaged me and said, I wasn't able to leave a voice message, but I have an idea for a top three. And I said, okay, what is it? And he said, I really, since Tony makes fun of you so much for Stallone and Schwarzenegger and all that, I would really love to do, because I know he has them, I want Tony Arkin's guilty pleasures top three movies that you don't admit in public that you love and you secretly adore. So I think we need to do that in an upcoming episode. Your secret guilty pleasure top three.
That's assuming I have anything even remotely like a guilty pleasure. I only have pleasures, Maddie. You know that.
You don't
only
have
only pleasures. I don't have any guilt over. I have a lot of guilt, but over this stuff, zero.
There's not a couple movies that you'd be a little reticent in a party of like Brooklyn hipsters to go like, oh my God, I love Eight Dresses.
In a group, in a party like that, all bets are off on what I would want to say.
Actually, you would go with the romantic comedy just to, because you're such an anarchist.
Well, I don't, anarchist. I'm such a boring dude.
I know. I love how I paint you like this, like renegade.
I get a bad rep, like from my brother, Matthew, on the other podcast that I do with my brother.
Arkin Brothers Talk Movies.
I generally try to go towards the more art movie or the older movies or like, you know, cult movies, just as a matter of interest, because I like talking about those. And he tried to punish me this month with rom-com month.
Because he loves rom-coms.
He really does. Like, he likes the format and the whole thing, and he cries at them and he likes them. And I have been pretty dismissive of that over the years, but that's I have a bad rap because there's someone that I like. I don't know if I'd be embarrassed to say, like, I don't know. There are probably TV shows that are comfort TV shows that I would put on the list. So
okay, well, I'm happy to do it. Marinate on it. I would like to give you that assignment next week. I want Tony Arkin's top three guilty
pleasures. I love it.
And I must say, because I really believe in cross promotion. I think it raises all boats. The Arkin Brothers Talk Movies is so good, and the one you did recently, what's the Julia Roberts movie you did?
Notting Hill.
Listening to Tony Arkin. If you're a fan of this podcast, listening to my partner, Anthony Arkin, try to review Notting Hill is must-listen podcasting. Go find it, and trust me. I was in bliss listening to that.
I had a better time with it than I thought I was going to. I wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure.
I just want to credit your brother with coming up with that.
He has, well, he punished me. Oh, boy. Oh. Last night's episode.
I missed it.
Pillow Talk. Rock Hudson and Doris Day.
Oh, I would think you would like that more than like a 90s, right? Because at least it's an oldie. You tend to like
it's not stuff. Binary, Maddie. I don't like any of, well, some of this I don't like no matter when it came out. This is like a low plimsoll line for movies in our culture, that time period.
Got it. All right. Well, let's get to our film review. Archive 81. Tony, before we do, let's tease everybody with what our top three actually will be tonight at the end of this episode. After we review Archive 81, what will our top three list be tonight?
God, you know, remind me what we said, because we've had so many iterations of it.
As a matter of fact, let me just do this. Let me break the fourth wall here and read a text exchange between me and Tony tonight.
Great.
In trying to think of what our top three could be.
This is perfect.
All right. So I unsolicited me to Tony, coming up with ideas for potential top threes based on Archive 81. Top three inappropriate uses of a camera, or top three pets based on the guy's rat, or top three cribs based on the house's suite in this movie, or top three gross molds. Tony reply, love top three gross molds or slimes. Or we could do, this is Tony, top three weakest use of the word fuck. LOL, my response. How about this? I write, top three, get that camera out of my face while we have long extended super private dialogue that is supposedly secret, but I'll keep telling it to you while you film me. Tony, ha ha ha. And what we settled on was basically the best or the worst top three. Let me see how we finally worded it. Oh, yeah. Top three first-person camera work in a film. That could include found footage. Anytime a character in a movie starts taping something, it's on our list. So top three first-person character camera work in film history will be our top three tonight.
I think that, yeah, that's better than I could have said it. Thank you for taking that responsibility.
Great. All right.
And I think we can publish, by the way, that string of, they're not tweets, but they're just texts, but I think we could probably sell that as a launch pad for another show or some kind of, you know.
Oh my God.
They're selling stuff now. People are looking everywhere for material.
Think we could make a, what do they call them? NFT out of that text exchange?
I think every show we do should be its own NFT. Hey, why not? You holding that cup, that's an NFT. It's green, it's moving around.
It's St. Patrick's Day. Well, let's keep the Irish cheer going with Archive 81. Here we go.
You are listening to the only podcast of its kind, hosted by two industry professionals. Host, actor, investigator, Maddie Blake.
I was slaying is what I was doing.
Actor, director, filmmaker, Anthony Arkin.
I'm just saying things to get health insurance.
Two friends with a love and passion for film and the paranormal.
I'm going to kill all of you.
Thoughtful analysis.
It's just
insider knowledge and intelligent conversation.
More cocaine on set. Is what I'm saying.
Find us on social media at Rated Paranormal.
Come on, kill me. Do it, I'm here.
To leave us a message, visit our homepage, anchor.fm/Rated Paranormal. Simply click message and let your voice be heard and click support to donate.
I hope you're tortured about it and that it bothers you.
Share the podcast and help grow the P4P community.
Who the hell is that? Shut the door!
Rated P for Paranormal, the best and worst of paranormal pop culture.
Boom. Netflix. Archive 81. Dan is hired by a mysterious company to restore video footage of grad student Melody's documentary project on an apartment building that burned down. And of course, madness then ensues. Tony, we kind of randomly picked this one based on a trailer that I think I saw on Netflix. It looked good, looked interesting. It was paranormal for sure. And we're trying to be hip every once in a while, do a streaming show, a current show. And it certainly dealt with the paranormal. That's for sure. And let me just say this too. It's an 8-part series, as I said, based on the podcast Archive 81 that began in 2016. It was released in 2022 on Netflix. And the series was watched for 128 million hours globally. According to Netflix top tens, that's 128 million hours that people aren't going to give back. Tony, what are your takeaways of Archive 81? Let's start with the pilot. I want to start with the pilot because you watched this all the way through. Yes,
I did. Yeah, I watched.
I did too. Okay, let's start with the pilot. Sometimes you see the pilot, you go, "Oh boy, I am in for a long slog," and you're right. Then other times. You watch a pilot, you think you're in for a long slog, and it kind of picks up steam and gets better. And then other times, you see a pilot that you love, and the show kind of goes downhill. This, for me, was the latter. I was very excited by the pilot, and I'll just come out with it. I think you can probably tell from our tone, I'm not a fan of Archive 81. I was a fan of the pilot, however.
I like the pilot, too. It you know, in fact, you know, how this worked was that you suggested we do the show. And because it's a season, it's like 8 episodes, it takes us some time to watch that sometimes. And we couldn't really I don't think we had the time to do a whole season's worth or a whole, you know, 8 episodes at that moment. But I had already started. We started. And then you kind of called me and said, I've gotten 3 episodes in. I don't know how I'm feeling about it.
That's right. That's right. I tried to throw you a warning.
Yeah. And, but I had seen the pilot and I thought the pilot was decent enough for me to continue. So I was like, well, I'd like to eventually do it. So the viewing of this has been a little broken up. I saw the first 2 or 3 episodes and then we stopped. And then a couple weeks went by and then I caught up with the rest of it. Not my favorite way to do it. Although when you got 8 episodes, I can binge 4 or 6, but we get into 8. I got to spread it out.
Yes. You got a life to lead.
And, so the, you know, my take on it is, you know, admittedly wasn't an ideal viewing scenario. And I'm like you, I was intrigued enough to actually root to do it and say let's continue.
Yes.
Because it does. I think for me, it's a very mixed bag. I can't, I really do, want to be supportive of it because, not just because it's popular, but this is one of those instances where its popularity, because it's a huge show right now.
It is.
Makes me want to take it seriously. Even if I'm not on board with it, I want to respect the people that are getting something out of it enough to really think about it, you know?
Of course.
Overall, very mixed bag. And I didn't come out being yeah, I can recommend everybody go see this. That being said, if like some of the things we've covered, I think if you're a fan of the genre that we're talking about or the micro genre that this is, you'll probably want to see it just because it deals with stuff in the Lovecraftian sense of horror, that if you're into that, you're going to get something out of the show, I think. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a waffly thing to say.
No,
I know,
no, it's not. No, it's fair because there are good moments throughout it. But I would just, my instinct is to shy people away from it because it's 8 episodes. I just wouldn't want someone to go through what I went through. And like, I feel like this could have been a really good movie perhaps, or a 3-episode arc.
I think it could have been a great 4 to 6 episodes. It's definitely right. At least 2 episodes long. And right. Like a lot of shows, and one of the things that keeps me from being as big a fan of a lot of streaming shows as I am movies still, is that most shows I feel just have to do this thing. Like they have to vamp through some episodes, and like vamping, I mean, just kind of like, hey, we're just going to kind of like, you know, play some chords and not really develop the story, but just kind of, you know,
well, I mean, look,
kind of it's make stuff up while we get to the end.
You're right. And it's worse than that because like the penultimate episode is, I don't know, 50 of the 60 minutes is a flashback to the 1920s.
Yeah.
And kind of telling us, showing us the story that we already know it is, but showing us how it happened. And man, when you introduce a whole new cast, all new faces, you know, 7 episodes into an 8-episode arc, that's asking a lot of us to care about those people at that point, I think. And I was just like, wow, I was like, okay, I'll take the 1920s flashback. And I'm like, oh God, this is the whole episode. Wow.
Yeah. I get it. I get you. I feel like maybe if it had been done a little bit more, with a little bit more care and thought, it might have worked. I mean, that by in of itself isn't for me a problem, because like you look at Twin Peaks, you know, season 3, there is a very famous standalone episode 8 that I think it's yes. 8 that is a complete departure from any narrative that
yes.
As if you could really follow a narrative to begin with. But like this one is in black and white and it's totally different. I like people playing with the form of that. So in a way, that's kind of the thing I like about streaming or, you know, this TV culture that we have right now where everything's episodic, is that it's starting to get a little more creative. People are starting to break away from like, no, the rules of a show, it has to be in this office. And I like breaking away from like a little bit of those traditions. However, when that whole episode felt like I was at a, you know, archival society recreation dinner theater thing of the 1920s, like, you know, it felt like LARPing. And
that's why I chose those words. Like, if you're going to do that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's asking yeah. a lot. So you got to do it well, you yeah. know, that was the implication, and they didn't do it well. So it was disappointing and confusing at times. There's a lot of different strands here, not different strands that I thought were particularly interesting. It just confusing and muddled.
Yeah. It was pretty muddled. How are you on this kind of horror, on cosmic horror? I mean, are you into it, or is that like
totally.
Is Lovecraft a writer that you've, you know, been into? Or
like I said, yeah, absolutely. And we had a recommendation from Kip, a fan of the show, to do some Lovecraft. So let's do that. Actually, we haven't.
I'd love to. Yeah,
let's do that next week. Let's pick a Lovecraft.
Great.
Okay, that's what we'll do next week. So yes, I do. What I love more. And that's why I was so excited by the pilot and even the second episode and the early stuff in this, is that I love isolation in film, isolation and dread and not knowing what's coming next. And I got to say, one of the huge credits I'll give this film is, or this show, excuse me, is our lead and what he does for a living. He restores old tape. And I found those scenes of him restoring the tape whenever he did it so fascinating, which is probably an indictment on the rest of it, because like I would watch him restore the video as the process of that more than I wanted to watch the paranormal stuff as represented in this film, or most of it. I thought that was fascinating. I thought it was creative. I thought it was different. He was great. He's a great actor. They're all great actors, you know, almost across the board, great performances. So yeah, like that whole thing I thought was really interesting. And I love the isolation horror. I love when someone is put in a house alone or a spaceship alone and told, you know, here you go. And there's a nefarious company of kind. I'm all in on that. Then it just kind of slowly let me down and let me down and let me down and let me down.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of agree. There's a big rift here. I really was completely on board with the story. I had no problem with the story they were trying to tell. I even liked a lot about the narrative. I even liked a lot about the way they told the story. I thought it was a really, really clever idea to have two narratives, one that took place in the 90s and one that took place today, that were tied together by two characters going through this kind of weird paranormal experience. And for a while, you don't know how they're connected. You know, he's watching tapes that this young woman made back in the 90s, and these are the tapes that he's restoring. He's looking for his father, who died in a fire, when he was young. His father ends up appearing in these tapes as this girl, as a therapist in the real world. He didn't know he was working on this case. So he's trying to unravel the mystery of his father. She is in the 90s, trying to find her mother who disappeared, connected to this apartment complex. So they're both on these different storylines. And so we keep cutting to, you know, from this guy, Dan, working in this studio he's been hired to work in and restoring these tapes, watching her movies, and then we kind of go into her world and see, kind of follow her timeline. Both timelines look a little bit different. They tried and succeeded for the most part in a pretty good recreation of the 90s, you know, with a low budget. Obviously, they didn't have a ton of money here. I mean, that's something to consider. You know, I think people under the mistaken assumption that Netflix has a lot of money to give these shows to produce them, and they're on a huge budget. They really are. So you're usually watching, you know, people trying to be very inventive to get the stuff done at the budgets they have. So I got to appreciate that.
In fact, let me say, a lot of these things are made independently and then sold to Netflix. So what you're seeing isn't necessarily Netflix spending money on something.
Exactly. Although in this case, I think this was
a Netflix joint. Yes.
But in either case, you're not going to be getting a ton of money unless you're already big stars, but these people really aren't. So I got to respect these are still indie filmmakers, you know, and trying to make this thing work. So I appreciated the effort on that. The two storylines really were a clever hook for me. And I thought that the fact that both storylines work with different kinds of horror was really interesting.
Yeah.
Conceptually. Yep. So her world, when we follow her story in the 90s, it's the horror of, you know, being surrounded by people that you can't necessarily trust. But, you know, she's in a big city. She's in an apartment complex, like a beehive of people and different characters and stuff. She's never alone. She's never by herself or isolated, really. There's always someone she could go to for help. She could go to a cop. She could scream. But there is that fear of, you know, who can you trust in this big maze of people in this building? Mm. His storyline is all about the fear of isolation, like you said. And it really does a kind of nice job of playing on that, the paranoia of being alone, which is really then more the fear of yourself. Like, am I going crazy?
Right.
Is he starting to lose it?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Like, is he going crazy or is what he's seeing real?
So I want to give props to a show that is like doing two different kind of like genres of horror and attempting that. And in some cases kind of succeeding. I applauded that. I thought that was great. Where it failed for me was in the character development, in the dialogue, and in emotional motivation. I just didn't feel the script was there for character at all. So it was weirdly like I have a lot of respect for the construction of it, but I don't feel like it's lacking a lot of soul to me, like a lot of, you know, like
well said. Yeah.
Humanity. I just couldn't track any of the people or why they did what they did or where their motivations were coming from.
Oh,
they were
God,
all very
yeah.
muted.
Yes.
Everything was extremely downplayed and kind of mopey. But that's not the other half of the movie, which is very, I thought, pretty interesting. So,
yeah, that's really well said. The development wasn't there. It was a little tropey. You knew really early on, instantly, you knew who was who. And there was kind of no layers, even though someone might be playing nice, but they're evil. There's a lot of that. There's right. a lot of people from the head of the CEO of the evil company conglomerate to Sam, the guy in the building,
his brother, who's the cult leader.
You're playing nice and you're evil. There wasn't a lot of nuance in between. Everyone's very tropey, and she was the damsel in distress, and our lead is the good guy. So yeah, you're right. It was very on the nose in terms of that. It was hard to get behind. Yeah,
they were interestingly like using a real wide variety of different kinds of references. You know. Yep. Like these two different kinds of horror of isolation, and then like this Rosemary's Baby vibe, which was like, you know, you're surrounded by people that you can't trust.
Right.
And then every single person you meet, you're like, oh, that's that person. And you're right.
Exactly.
Every time.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes,
no subtlety to that. Nuance.
No. And I was actually surprised in its obviousness. I kept waiting for his podcast best buddy to like turn and be the bad guy. And
me too. Like, no, me too.
Right. Right. Like he's behind it all somehow with his father's money.
And I actually appreciated that they didn't. Because that was the one time they tried to make you kind of think maybe somebody was, and then they weren't. Like every other character is just like, hi, I'm a bad guy.
Yeah. There's a scene at the end where he says to him, Dan, our lead, is trying to convince his best friend, this kid who runs this podcast, which by the way doesn't exist in real life. No one has a podcast that provides their living and is like super ridiculously famous, unless you're a celebrity or work for NPR. But
he couldn't even afford those film posters on a podcast budget. Exactly. Let's face it.
Exactly. And like there's a live audience going to his podcast recording me tonight. Like, come on.
Which we never hear either. Like, that's the other thing. Like, we don't even know. We're just told that he does this, but we don't ever see any evidence.
By the way, quick aside, Only Murders in the Building, Steve Martin, Martin Short. Super fun.
That's what this just go see that.
Go like, see that. Amen. It's actually scarier.
It is.
This kid, the podcast kid, Dan, is trying to convince his best friend into basically sending him into this world that would mean possibly his death. And his friend stands up to him and says, like, no way, I'm not doing this. I love you too much. You know, he gives him this tender speech about like, I love you. Think I'm doing this for my podcast? I care about you, man. I'm not going to let you do that. But if that's what you really want to do, okay, I'll help. I just picture the screenwriter going like, how do I get him to do it? Okay,
hit the nail on the head. I mean, I've got two examples here of screenwriting that just made me want to bite my fingers off.
Thank you.
I was so upset. They use this thing all the time. There's a little exchange that they use. It's like a go-to in every scene. I'll give you an example. Someone is talking to the girl and they say, he took her. And she says, what do you mean he took her? Or somebody will say to someone else, he's gone. And that person goes, what do you mean he's gone?
Yes.
And I'm serious, like no, literally 150
yes,
times.
Yes, yes. And in the last three episodes, somebody says some iteration of, fuck off or go fuck yourself.
What happened? Like literally
no less than 100 times.
Episode 6, she starts dropping the F-bomb.
Yep.
And it doesn't stop. And it becomes like an infection. And everybody else starts dropping it inappropriately.
Dan, yes.
Dan starts doing it. And the funny part is, this is one of the reasons I wanted to do this as a top three.
Yeah.
None of them know how to say fuck.
I know. It's so true.
The weakest F-bombs.
It's so true.
They're giving it their all, but none of them are like, they don't even know how to say it. Maybe that's just our generation knows how to say it. No, nobody else does. Maybe it's like, how do you say that word? Fuck.
Go fuck yourself.
It's like really insane. I wrote this down. Like, why all of a sudden, like they got a memo from Netflix saying, you got to fuck this up.
More fucks. We need to get edgy.
Fuck the hell out of this.
Yes. Yes.
So,
it was distracting.
It's really weird. Then, there's another little exchange of brainlessness in the writing. Brainless, like literally not thinking, like writing and just not, you're thinking about something else.
Right.
Near the end, I think it's episode 7, the girl's friend, who's been in a mental institution because of a breakdown that she had, which was brilliantly handled, by the way, just so brilliantly handled, has been keeping a package for Dan, who knows her from another time and space and dimension, for 20 years, something that she gave her to give to him. And she says, she left something for you. I want you to have it. Now just think about that for a second. What does that have? It's mine. What is you wanting me to have it have anything to do with this? If it weren't yours and you was something, it was something of yours that you give me, you could say that. This is not, you have.
Yes.
And it just, there was, this was happening all the time. There were things where characters would like race somewhere because they had to get somewhere, and then they'd get there and that it wouldn't happen. Nothing happened. They just literally like, well, we got to get her over to the apartment somehow. So we'll create a diversion and it's an emergency, but then she'll get to the apartment and they won't even bring up what the whole
she was
motivating
running from. There's nothing. A lot of running to halls to different rooms. And then there's just like, it's over. The running was over. Yeah. And similarly, I can't say that word. Similarly, Dan, something traumatic, paranormal, creepy happens to him. And he's just, wakes up from the dream.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point where, which is fine, because that's the thing. Is it real? Is it not? Is he dreaming? Is it not? I get it. But then when you're in the weeds in the final two episodes, like, you know, this stuff is actually happening to him. And this, and he's just like, he's going to wake up. He's going to get out of it by waking up. So then you're watching it going like, okay, I know that he's going to wake up in seconds. And he always does.
Always. They never change that up, play with it, trick you.
Right.
No. And nor does he ever seem to get used to it. I like every time it's like, what happened? Like the same thing that happened to you in episode one.
Yes, he keeps falling for it. At some point you'd be like, wait a second, this is the part where I wake up and it's in my bed. Maybe I shouldn't touch this. Oh, and by the way, to an earlier top three we did, there's a bunch of why you're
touching.
This
is the king
that?
Of why. I mean, honestly, this is probably the king of don't touch, why are you touching that?
She literally goes insane about the black mold on the walls, like confronts the lead evil lady, like, you're fucking doing this to her. It's the mold, isn't it? It's the mold that's driven her psychotic. And then she goes down to the thing and rubs her fingers through
all
the mold after you just said
it's psychotropic. You don't touch it. Like, it clearly you don't. Yeah. Everybody touches it knows. That's the thing. Like, another don't why you're touching that movies, at least they don't know what it is.
She has solved it in her mind. It's this mold that's causing all this wickedness. I think I'll go down and just like and just CSI rub,
rake my like gloveless fingers,
butter
over and it and smell it. Put it near my face. What is going on?
Oh my god.
Yeah. And again, like, there's a thing where that wasn't necessary. Nobody had to touch it for the plot, and they don't get infected by it. She didn't touch it and nothing happened. So why are you, why? And you know, this is kind of what I'm saying, because it's one of these things about, and I go on about character and like veracity and believing these, you know, believing in characters. You've got to believe that they're real people in order to go on a trip like this with them, because none of it's really believable. You have to suspend your disbelief, right? So when they keep on offering up these small little paper cuts in realistic reality, in realistic human behavior, in realistic emotions, in what people would do, down to like, people wouldn't touch disgusting mold with their bare hands.
Well,
just because
you once said on this podcast, to make me believe the crazy big paranormal things, you at least have to make me believe the simple human things.
Yeah.
And people might touch that mold not knowing what it is. The last person on planet Earth who would touch that mold is her.
Exactly.
Because she solved it
and just found out what it is.
Right. And her whole case is predicated on, this is the mold that's killing my friend and doing all that. And then she'd be the last one to rub her fingers through it. So it's just like, someone's got to make that call in the writer's room and go, hold on. Whoa.
Yeah. Why are we just, don't just
how
take
about
it out.
The, how about have the bad guy in his reveal rub his hands to it and put it to her face? Like, how
right,
about that?
Because he wants it. He likes
it. Right.
I agree.
And can I talk about the video camera? I just want to talk about the
All right. Well, camera. We could go on about this because this All is right. related to our top three.
It is. Yeah. So maybe this is a good segue. So the conceit is, which I have no problem with, it's been used before, as we're going to get into, but it, specifically this has been used before, that a character is making some sort of documentary and so then must be justified in scenes holding a video camera. But at a certain point in this thing, her motivation is supposedly to find her deceased mother. At a certain point, she is so far beyond that in so many ways. And yet every scene, because Dan, our lead, needs to see this footage in current day, she is holding the camera in scenes and moments where no human would ever hold the camera in someone's face ever. So it becomes very distracting.
It's a pet peeve of mine, to the point where I actually had trouble getting this top three list together, honestly. Like, that's the reason, is because I tune out when I see it. Because I work with cameras and I shoot some stuff. I'm not a DP, but I've shot some things for movies, and I work with cameras, and I know how people shoot, and I know what footage is, and I know what it looks like. And it amazes me that people that make movies put in movies things that are completely ridiculous with cameras and movies. Like, it doesn't work that way. First of all, what is tape? Apparently tape is free. Apparently you can run tape endlessly without ever changing a tape. She doesn't have a bag of tapes with her.
That's right.
I mean, look, I used to shoot with that, literally that Sony Handycam that she had.
Yeah,
I had that
mini DVs, rather, mini DV tape. Yeah,
I these were high eight tapes.
Yeah,
I believe this was high digital eight.
Yeah,
they were oversized, like cassette tapes is what they look like.
Right,
oversized,
blocky. Yeah,
and they were cool cameras at the time, you know. And that's not how you shot with them. That's not how you use them. She's also never framing a shot or looking into the viewfinder or the screen at ever, at any point. She's running and having it like on the, like to her side, pointing it up at the sky while she's talking to people. There's just simply no reality to the way that prop is treated or how those cameras worked or any of it.
And as I joked you in the text line, it becomes by episode like five or so, people are revealing things to her that are supposedly secret. They're having this intimate dialogue about giving up secrets to these things, like, well, what really happened? And she's got the camera in their face. And it's never addressed many times. It's just completely ridiculous. You know what it reminds me of? I have another pet peeve. I have my Dubois. My second pet peeve is coffee cups in film. And also throw in their births, as I've said, live births in movies and television shows, but like the birthing scene, but coffee cups and shows. I was watching a show with my wife recently, Schitt's Creek, which is a very funny show. But in that show, it's a prime example of it. There's a coffee shop across the street. So in 90% of the scenes, the characters have coffee cups and they are so clearly violently empty. People don't hold cups like that. And if there's some liquid in it, it's going to be held a different way. And they're literally, in certain scenes, having dialogue going like this, so Tony can see me, and the cup sideways and clearly empty. And then it smash cuts to them like fake sipping. I'm like, why not just put some water in it? We can put cold water in it and they'll handle it differently.
They won't because water can splash on your costume and eat up money and time. I mean, that's why, but the sad part is like, so pretend, act better. Similarly, like I have a thing, Amelia really has a thing when we're watching stuff and somebody's driving and not paying attention to not looking at the road. Like they're like looking at their lover in the seat next to them and driving, just longingly looking at them or talking, drives me crazy too. I mean, but that's what I'm talking about. These little details, like if you can't, if you know, there's so many fake things going on. There's green screen. There's all this. There's supernatural stuff. There's kind of some bad CGI. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, there is.
There is some bad CGI in this show, which they didn't need at all.
At all.
I don't know why they spent the money or time on it.
The creepy part was like, or what could have been creepy was the people in the masks, the eyes wide shut, the Rosemary's Baby elements, and then it becomes this blue tornado of CGI, and the ghost from the 20s comes back and is just standing there like a,
yeah, it's like Stargate. Before. It looks like, yes, Stargate.
Or like a Disney ghost.
Here's another great moment. Like, I won't give anything away, but there's near the end, there is one of these like supernatural funnels that opens up with like, you know, it's starting, and you know, they will only have a couple of minutes before you can enter. And, apparently he knows when to go in. Like, that was the thing. I'm like, he's just like, he's waiting and waiting and like, okay, how do you know when it's the right time to enter another dimensional portal? Well, he just seems to know. And like the witch who's controlling everything doesn't go like, he just seems to know, like, now's the time to walk into the, how would you know that?
Super specific ritualistic process. He's strolls right through the,
without like at least looking concerned that maybe you were getting it wrong.
Nothing ever really came to fruition with the alien ghost. There's some sort of alien demon ghost that we see literally crawling through screens, and it's the foreboding monster throughout the series. And did I just fast forward through this? So like, did they kill it, or was it addressed again after we see it in the mirror? They just see it and run away to another room constantly.
Well, no, I mean, I think without being too spoilerific, this is the season one. I mean, nothing really did get resolved at all, because if this show's a big hit, they're going to do another season, and they were counting on that. They didn't resolve anything.
Well, as I say at the beginning of each episode, all right. Tony, I think we've, anything we've left off the table in Archive 81?
Not really. I will say that there were a couple of anachronisms that bothered me. Sometimes when younger filmmakers are making movies about the 90s, which was our time.
Yes.
And they put things in it like, yes, oh, like sticky tape on the back of a manila envelope, which they didn't have then. Like, ugh, we had to staple that stuff, man. Mm-hmm. You had to staple. That's why we had a stapler,
right?
It's not a big deal, but it's just like those little things. You're like, all right, that's not real. Okay,
you got her high jeans, like her literally high blue jeans, correct?
She got the mom jeans. That was very 90s. The money. The leather coat that she had was cool. Mm-hmm. You know, that was good. I don't know. I mean, look, if you really have a thing for this kind of mashup, you know, where you love Rosemary's Baby and you just need a hit of this kind of thing, then put it on the background, give it a whirl, check it out, see if it works for you. I don't know. A lot of people like it. We're in the minority here.
Yeah, I guess we are. Welcome to our world.
Yeah, welcome to our planet.
Welcome to our nightmare. Okay, Tony, so in the end, I think it's fairly obvious this is not going to get a P for paranormal. It's going to get a P for pass, unfortunately, from both of us. Won't make,
I feel bad about it though.
I do,
because I respect what they were trying to do, you know. I know how hard it is to hit that, you know. Sometimes it's just really hard to do it, so I feel bad, but I can't offer it more love, but I can't.
All right, so let's get to our top three list, inspired by Melody from Archive 81, who we've described is constantly videotaping people with a camcorder. This is our top three first person filming moments in film history, that is, characters who film things, for right or for wrong, for good or for bad. It'll all be better than what we saw in this, what we saw her doing. So, Tony, would you like me to begin, or would you like to begin?
How would you like to do it, Maddie?
I'll go with number three, which is going to kind of wash this version of taping someone in a film off our hands, because it's so well done. It might be the kind of gold standard of someone taping someone in a movie, and that is the 2014 film Creep, which is an underrated, I guess, in some circles, film about a guy who's hired to videotape another guy who he doesn't know. He answers an ad, as I remember it, and it's a terrifying movie, and it's really good. And it's one of those Blair Witch examples where I never really got sick of the found footage, shaky handheld camera thing, which is an accomplishment, right?
I agree. I like that movie too. And I think the, you know, if I may, I think the reason why you liked it that way was because I think they were very realistic and truthful about how that thing would actually have been shot.
Right.
They, you know, right. It feels like they paid attention to the reality of what found footage would be like, what you would be able to tape, how it just felt more realistic.
Right. Yeah. That's you hit the nail on the head.
That's a good call.
All right. Yeah. What's your number three, buddy?
My number three, and I did do two versions of this. I did the worst and the best because I didn't know how you'd be going. You're going serious.
No, because it's
a variety. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do top three, and in each one, I'm going to give you the worst and the best.
I love it.
So my the top three for me on for the best would go to a movie. Number three would be a movie called Wreck, REC for record.
Oh, okay.
I believe it's Spanish. I think it's made in Spain. It was remade into a movie called Quarantine in the States.
Okay.
Jennifer Carpenter, which was fun.
Oh,
but
okay.
Wreck is really, really terrifying.
Really?
Yeah. It's
I
really
never saw that.
Really good.
I'm writing it down.
It's about basically, you know, a zombie kind of movie, zombie outbreak movie, like the very, very beginning of it. And it all takes place, fire crew goes into an apartment building to attend to something that's happened, and they get stuck in there. And it's like ground zero for the start of this zombie pandemic. And it's really scary.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to that's on my queue right now.
So that's number three. The good side,
yeah,
the side of light and good and goodness. On the bad side, I'm going to go for number three, Mickey and Scream, the character who has the video camera in the movie Scream.
Yeah.
I wanted to rip it out of his hands and smash it. Belushi smashed that guitar in Animal House. I couldn't stand it.
Absolutely. And then the cutaways there's always the cutaways to the footage that you're, it's just, what was the movie we reviewed where they keep cutting away? Oh, the one we hated, the Sasquatch found footage one.
That's
oh, all right.
That's on my, I mean, that's,
I'll be quiet.
Like,
I'll be quiet. Know, okay. Yeah. All right.
That actually could be like an honorable mention of all time.
That should
just
be the
disastrous
one. That's okay. All
which right. is incredible because it's the same guy who made Blair Witch. Like, you didn't learn anything about footage movies from making the granddaddy. Okay.
We got sucker punched on that one. Go back and listen to that episode. Okay. My number two is a very iconic first person handheld, especially camcorder specifically. In fact, it, from what I read about it, it launched this camera, its sales. And that's, of course, Marty McFly filming Doc in the parking lot.
Great call.
And he does a really crappy job of filming in a way, but all hell breaks loose, so who can blame them?
They kind of use that as a part of it. They kind of incorporate it. Yeah, that's a good call.
And it's like,
that's
who keeps filming when you're being shot at?
Great,
by...
great call.
Just iconic. It was the first, when we brought up the topic, it was literally the first image, him holding that camcorder, that JVC, I think it was, camcorder.
I love it. Number two, for me, best category, VHS 2. There is a segment in that film. It's an anthology movie.
Yep.
I think VHS 2 is better than VHS 1. It's actually a all around better group of shorts, but there's the second one. I think it's the second film. It's by Gareth Evans, who did Raid Redemption. I don't know if you ever saw Raid Redemption.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
He's an amazing filmmaker. He made a short in here called Safe Harbor, which is completely terrifying.
Okay.
Just utterly not fun to watch and fun at the same time. It's about a group of people that infiltrate. They don't infiltrate. They go in to get an interview with a cult leader I think it's in South Korea, and they get to talk to him on a very special day. It's great. It's really
all
great.
Right.
Number two for don't watch, I'm going to go for Redacted from Brian De Palma, who made the worst anti-war movie I've ever seen, because I wanted to go to war with him after this. It's all found, it's like all security camera footage. It's all like handy cam stuff, and it's fake, and it's cobbled together. And it's, I'm like, you can't believe the man had ever made a movie before, let alone some great movies. Like, it is so rough. Bad times.
You know, there's a movie I can't think of the name of when I was trying to think of this list. And there's a lot of, there's handheld and security cam footage. There was a lot of that in the, like the early 90s. You know, security cam cutaways was a very popular thing to do. And they would say things like, the whole wing of this building is run by computers. You know what I mean? Like, computers are kind of new.
Yes. You know what I mean? Yeah. And they were in a lot of, they're always in movies of casinos too. They're always using all the casino cameras that they have. And so sometimes they use them great. De Palma did a great job with that, you know, in Snake Eyes and other movies. But what's your,
all right. Number one, best use of first person filming camcorder in movie history. In my opinion, it's the scene that I just loved. And yes, it doesn't work in Sly. He's in the honorable mentions. Of course. You know, I'll always work him in.
But I already did it. I thought maybe that would preempt you.
That will not satiate my Sly love. No, never. But my number one is from True Lies, a movie we've mentioned here on this podcast before. But I don't know if you remember, there's a scene when they're trying to be super dramatic terrorists and leave their, we're going to chop this person's head off terrorist video. And the guy, you'll remember when I say it, the battery dies in the middle of his it is such a great moment. And you know, you use, like Mel Brooks used to say, like the best way to get back at the Nazis is to just completely satirize them. And so these terrorists are going like, if you do not, the blood of Allah will spill upon you, and he's like beep 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 beep.
Well, that's so true to life. I mean, that's the kind of reality that is a filmmaker that you're used to.
It's such a great scene. I just love it.
Definitely. So
True Lies.
All right. Good. Good. I'm glad you worked in Schwarzenegger.
Stand by for the Sly.
So number one for me, I'm gonna flip this and do top number one least favorite for me. And it's a movie I like, but the conceit of the camera work in it drives me out of my freaking mind. Cloverfield. They had this decision to make, like, are we going to, you know, why does somebody film all of this?
Right. When it gets really bad, why would they still be filming?
Which is a problem that all these movies have, most of them have, where you're like, well, there's a point at which nobody would bother to film any of this. So why are we seeing it? So sometimes they'll put a camera down somewhere on a table and just let it run accidentally. And it just happens to be framing the action. It
falls and lands.
Yeah, there's a lot of things.
You're looking at it sideways in the room. Yeah.
But their decision in this movie was to just make this guy's inability with the camera like a running thing, which turned out to be even worse, because you just hear him grunting and going, if I got the focus right, and I don't want to go into that room. And then they're like, come on, we got to keep making the movie, so you got to come on. And I went out of my freaking mind. But I even enjoyed the movie, but
it's a good movie.
That drove me insane. Number one, absolute, with a bullet, which is an inappropriate term to use for this movie, but Man Bites Dog. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Yeah, my God. Yeah.
Man Bites Dog, to me, is
that was a you recommendation to me.
I probably did that to you. Sounds like you something did. Awful that I did.
I've said this on the podcast before. Every traumatic experience I've had in film,
but thanks to me,
100%.
I did something right in this world. Man Bites Dog is a French movie from the early 90s that is completely found footage, essentially. It is a fake movie shot by a fake undergrad crew of filmmakers in film school. These guys, the characters of these filmmakers, are following a serial killer, a killer, or a thief, a criminal. They don't know that he's a serial killer at the time. But as their thesis project, they want to do a really gritty movie and follow this criminal around. And it's very believable. Nothing is shot that wouldn't be shot. The reality of what you're seeing is so extreme that a lot of people, when it came out, really thought it might have been real. It's extremely disturbing. I would say it's probably the funniest movie I've ever seen, and also probably the most messed up.
But super uplifting ending.
Very uplifting. Yeah. Who doesn't like a success story?
Thanks for that, Tony. I now have to think about that movie again. Get it out of my mind. Okay. Honorable mention. I've only got one. It's the, you talk about, now this is my bad one. The other ones okay. I gave were like examples of funny or good ones. This is my bad one. You talk about when I take a camera out of a kid's hands and smash it. From Rocky IV, the now infamous robot scene when he gives Polly a robot for his birthday. Well, he gives his son also for that Christmas, he gets a camcorder and the son keeps like just filming everyone, Rocky's son. It's like too big for him. It's unwieldy. And they keep cutting the footage of the scene because the kid's eyes, and you just want to like, just, it's a Rocky movie. Get rid of the camera.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, in the new cut of Rocky IV, he deletes the entire robot scene. So it was
wow,
very sad.
So that was like Jar Jar Binks for the Rocky franchise.
Yes, the robot, exactly right.
Oh my God, I don't remember that. Well, I have to remember not to go back to check it out and just take your word for it because it sounds rough.
Yeah, on your next viewing with Amelia of Rocky IV, yeah, I want to fast forward that.
Every
year, what do you guys do that Tuesday nights?
Well, it's usually a St. Patty's tradition, but maybe I don't know if I'll have time.
Did you have any honorable mentions, or did you get them all out?
No, I mean, it exists. The Bigfoot movie that we saw. It may just be the worst of all, but
yeah, I think it was.
I do want to give a shout out to Troll Hunter, which I think is a really, really cool movie.
Okay.
And let's give a shout out to Orson Welles while we're at it, because he made a movie called The Other Side of the Wind
that he never
finished when he was alive. Oh. He died before it was ever finished.
Okay.
And his friends, including Peter Bogdanovich, re-edited all this footage that he'd taken with multiple cameras over years. And they finally cut it together. A lot of it is fake, real footage of a fake event, documentary footage that is recreated. And he was doing this, in the 60s and 70s, way before most people were even thinking of doing this kind of thing. So
ahead of his time.
In a lot of ways, this whole idea was something Orson Welles had before Blair Witch, before anybody was thinking about found footage stuff.
A true visionary. That's awesome. I do seem to remember the announcement that was being put together. I remember like some newspaper article or magazine article about found footage of Orson Welles are going to cut that movie together. Yeah. I never saw it.
It's on Netflix, I think. I mean, it was streaming and I think they put it out. So
I've got Wreck and that one on the top of my queue. Right
now. That's a weird one. I mean, it's just, you know, dip in and dip out maybe, but.
Speaking of weird, let's go Lovecraft. Tony, I'm thinking maybe for Lovecraft. I mean, there's a bunch of ways we could go with Lovecraft, but maybe the most Lovecraftian in terms of what it portrays and shows might be In the Mouth of Madness, which is a Carpenter movie, which maybe you would like to
address. I know that movie well. Could I suggest a different one if we're going down that road?
Yep.
If we're really going to do Lovecraft.
Yep.
Because Mouth of Madness is inspired by Lovecraft. But there's a movie from around the similar time, maybe a little earlier. I think it's an 80s movie called From Beyond, which is actually based on Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And it's a movie I haven't seen in a while, but I was really keen on back in the day. And would you like to do that?
Let's do that. That wasn't. Yeah. Let's do that. Definitely. Absolutely.
That wasn't what?
No, I was going to say, I thought it was related to Reanimator, but I think it's just similar. But it's
same director.
There you go. Okay. There you go. Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Then let's do that. Yeah. Then let's do that then. Okay. I haven't seen From Beyond in a wicked long time. Yeah. From Beyond was 80s and Mouth of Madness was 90s.
It was early 90s. Yeah. There's a few and we could also, you know, I don't know if you want to do like a few in a row or I mean,
let's start with From Beyond. Cause that is, you're right. That is like authentic Lovecraft.
It's literally Lovecraft story.
Yeah. Literally. Whereas the month was like Lovecraftian themes shown in it. Right. Okay. All right, let's do it. So that's our movie for next week. Brush up on your Lovecraft. If you don't know anything about him, maybe read a little bit about what it was he did and who he was. And then we will watch that film here next week and all the madness will begin. And before the episode, Tony, we're going to have to slice our hands in a blood oath. So,
oh yeah. Oh, I already did. I'm sorry. I'm dripping. Right. Would you?
Here, let me just do one now.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Fuck yourself.
'Cause something like this. How do you know when it's the right time to enter another dimensional portal?